Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today, I spoke with John Sides, the author of The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election. I had the real pleasure to talk to John about this book and about some of the interesting ways that it's being published by Princeton University Press. Apologies in advance for the barking dog in the background. I hope that it's not too distracting. Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and I have the pleasure today to speak with John Sides. Hi, John.
Hi, Heath. Thanks for having me on.
It's a real pleasure. It's a pleasure to have read the start of this book, or at least a couple of the chapters, and to talk to you about this. And so I'm very interested in talking both about what's in the published parts of this so far, but also about what goes behind this unique early release of it. And so before we get to that, maybe you can just talk a little bit about who you are, what your background is, and where you are now.
I'm a professor in the political science department at George Washington University. And one of the things that's interested me since my graduate school days is the dynamics of political campaigns, and not just the decisions that candidates make, but also whether those decisions actually impact voters.
Wonderful. And I think the at least from what I've read so far of the book is just really, really interesting. And we'll talk about what's in there and what is to come as well. And so let's talk about the book and your co-author as well. How did you two come to write this specific book?
A couple years ago at a political science conference, my co-author, Lynn Babrick, convened a panel of people to talk about the state of campaigns research. And one of the things that I said at that panel was that it should be possible for political scientists to write a book about a campaign, do it in a way that's informed by political science research and data, and publish it within a year of the election. Meaning we should be able to work a little faster than we do, and if we did, perhaps the political science view of the election would actually get more, you know, penetration.
Yeah, and so this is a quick publication, and so quick that in some ways you've jumped the election by a few months. So, you know, as sort of reading this, you've really made it in some ways difficult for the rest of us to claim that we need multiple years to submit our finished monographs. Kind of up the bar, and so maybe you could talk a little bit more about this unusual pre-release. It sounds like some of this was your idea. What was the conversation you had with the publisher about this?
Princeton University Press is obviously, you know, typically in the business of traditional academic publishing, but they were really eager and willing to innovate on their publishing model and use this project as sort of a guinea pig. And so what Lynn and I agreed to do with them is for us to write chapters more or less in real time and try to get at least a few of those chapters out before the election itself. And we've published two thus far. And then the other component of our involvement is not only to write the book, but also to be relatively visible blogging and providing commentary for news outlets during the campaign itself, so that, you know, we have maybe a higher profile, and that helps to give the book additional momentum once it's actually published.
Yeah, and so this works a little bit like the series that I think Politico has been doing, where they're putting out a couple chapters sort of on the process of the campaign, and so you're sort of able to read it. And I assume those will also be put together at some point into a final book.
That's right. That's absolutely the model. I think what's happened in publishing is, you know, it's not just enough to get a print volume put together and published quickly. I think increasingly you have to have an ongoing electronic presence of sorts, and then you know, try to leverage that to provide additional oomph to the book.
Yeah. And so, I mean, not specifically how you've gone about editing this book, but I wonder if you had any, you know, sort of questions of how are we going to do this on the editorial side? How are we going to get the feedback necessary to know that what we're doing is sort of error-free and clean? Are you two working together? Do you have sort of outside people providing you with feedback so that you know so that this real rapid turnaround is done also in a way that's clean of error?
There's a 3 year or so different levels of vetting in some ways. There's the formal peer review process that Princeton has initiated. And what's innovative about that is they're peer reviewing the chapters on a rolling basis. And so the electronic chapters that we've already released have been through peer review. Secondly, we're, of course, consulting with other friends and colleagues and just trying to solicit their feedback on the manuscript, either, you know, just giving them written chapters or presenting data from the chapters at different universities. And then finally, by blogging about it, what we're hoping is that people's response to the blog posts and comments and so forth will also help us improve things and catch some mistakes. And that, in fact, has already happened in some of the research that I was publishing at the 538 blog at the New York Times. The initial first cut at that just raised some eyebrows, and commenters there and at the Monkey Cage just thought that things didn't look quite right. And, you know, the more I looked at the analysis, the more I realized that was correct. And so I was able to publish an updated version that didn't change our story wholesale, but it certainly was, I think, a much better analysis as a consequence of that. So in some sense, what we're doing is crowdsourcing a certain amount of the peer review.
Right. No, it's really interesting. And what's also very interesting is the actual book. So let's talk about just that. So one of the chapters deals with the Republican primaries, and I wonder if we can just start off by talking a little bit about endorsements. So you claim that they are a misunderstood aspect of the primary season. So what is the public, or what is the field, or what do people get wrong about the endorsements? Do they matter? Do they not matter? If they matter, in sort of what way do they matter?
Well, the political science research suggests that endorsements are the most visible signal of how political elites are judging their respective candidates. And increasingly, political elites are trying to coordinate, even in advance of the actual primaries, on a front runner. And in doing so, give that person additional resources and additional leverage, momentum, even heading into the Iowa caucus. And so one of the things that we do in the book is try to document just how many of these elites are endorsing and who they are endorsing. And that gives us a sense of just which candidate is the true front runner and who's, you know, probably favored to win. What makes 2012 interesting is that, Romney got the largest number of endorsements of any candidate. And then, of course, goes on to get the nomination, which is exactly what you would expect. But there were relatively few party leaders endorsing in 2012 relative to other elections. So the party was really slow to come around to Romney as the front runner, and even then, I think a lot of people were basically sitting this one out, or at least keeping their powder dry. So one consequence of that, we argue, is that when the party really hasn't coordinated as effectively as it has in some other elections, I think that just left the field more wide open and probably made it more possible for all the various surges to happen. You know, from Perry to Kane to Gingrich to Santorum.
Yeah, and let's talk about those actual surges. You refer to boomlets in the book, use this frame, boomlets. So what is a boomlet, and how does it relate to someone like Herman Cain?
So we think of as a boomlet is like a little surge where the typical process that happens is there's some catalytic event that draws the attention of news coverage. So in Herman Cain's case, it was the fact that he won a non-binding straw poll in Florida in the fall of 2011. And that sort of new, interesting, novel, dramatic event, you know, generates a lot of news coverage for the candidate. And we argue in some sense that's a process of discovery. You know, a candidate that's been in the race for a while but really hasn't gotten a lot of news coverage, all of a sudden people say, oh, who is this guy? And they start paying attention to him, and there's a lot of news coverage of him. But the problem is that for any candidate that becomes the front runner in that fashion, inevitably, you know, your opponents begin to attack you, and the news media begins to scrutinize your record more closely. And those two things combine to, I think, bring about, if not skeptical coverage, at least coverage that is not purely about how, you know, wonderfully you're surging in the polls. It's, you know, skeptical news accounts about things that you did in the past. You know, in Rick Perry's case, you had his, the name of his ranch in Texas, Niggerhead. You had, you know, his comments about Social Security being a Ponzi scheme. In Herman Cain's case, obviously, you had the revelations about the accusations of sexual harassment and sexual assault. So with the scrutiny, I think the boom is really cresting and then beginning to be over. And ultimately what happens, I think, is there's a gradual decline that's usually facilitated by the discovery of yet another candidate. And so you have the cyclical pattern. We call them boomlets to sort of suggest that they're not necessarily anything that's truly durable or meaningful. It's really a dynamic largely driven by news coverage and the incentives of news coverage and the fact that voters, lacking any kind of other information about these candidates, is very sensitive to, you know, who seems to be getting a lot of favorable coverage right now.
Right, right. In economics, they refer to this as creative destruction in a kind of an analogous way. So let's move on to the other side of the ledger and talk about the president. How similar are these conditions faced by the president in 2012 to those faced by Reagan either in 1980 or in 1984? You spend some time in the chapter talking about these comparisons.
There were several people wondering for a while whether Obama was going to end up like Jimmy Carter, you know, struggling amidst a weak economy, ultimately becoming a one-term, you know, Democratic incumbent president. And, you know, we don't think that's a very good analogy, neither 1980 or 1984. The problem is that the economy in 2012 is actually, you know, significantly better than it was in 1980. And unfortunately for Obama, it's not nearly as good as it was in 1984. So it's really somewhere between. It's not sufficiently bad enough to disadvantage him in the way that Carter was disadvantaged, but it's not going to give him the advantage that Reagan had in 1984. It's probably closest on balance to the economy in a year like maybe 1992 or 2004. And we think that on balance, the economic fundamentals are slightly to somewhat in Obama's favor, depending on which kinds of economic indicators you're looking at. And if that's the case, then this is even more reason why 1980 is really not the right analogy. On balance, I think we would say the economic fundamentals predict that Obama should win. And in 1980, that certainly wasn't true for Carter. At the same time, they probably don't predict that he's going to win by very much.
Right, right. And maybe we can get to this business of making predictions in just a little bit. And just before that, talk a little bit about this idea, or expand a little bit on this idea that the president's popularity is above what it should be. You do some interesting work on sort of trying to understand, based on these fundamentals, what the level of popularity should be versus what it actually is. So how did you go about answering that question that you ask in the hand you're dealt chapter of the book?
I was just struck by the fact that Obama's approval was so stable over the last, you know, many months, even though it seemed like the economic news from the country was, you know, on a good day, mediocre, and on a bad day, kind of dispiriting. So what we did was we put together a fairly traditional model of presidential approval, which uses three different economic indicators related to gross domestic product, unemployment, and inflation, as well as a handful of other factors that people have identified as important in predicting presidential approval. For example, we count up the number of events in any potential particular quarter of the year where you know, things might have given Obama a boost or not, like the killing of Osama bin Laden, for example. And you put all those together into the model, and then you look at the record of presidential approval from 1948 through 2008, and then you say, okay, you know, based on what this model would predict, where should Obama be in 2009 through 2011, 2012, and then where is he actually? And it's this gap between what the model predicts and where Obama is that the chapter focuses on. And at this point, we've looked at that model up through the first quarter of 2012, and we just found that towards the end of this time period, he is probably somewhere between 3 to 6 points more popular than he should be. And if that's true, then it's a potentially consequential difference, because I think, if, you know, going into 2012, having popularity perhaps somewhere around 46%, 47%, you know, really put him right on the bubble between favored to win and likely to lose. And if that number was 3 to 6 points lower, closer to 40%, then I think he would be in more trouble. Now, the open question that remains, and this is for, you know, the print edition of the book, is, you know, how much that continued to be true, you know, sort of continuing through the election year.
Right, right. And so let's just get to this, so the business of making predictions and modeling presidential outcomes. you are either ankle deep in this or waist deep on this, and have gotten a lot of attention, and there's a lot of conversation around this business of making these kind of predictions. And so, without ruining the next 6 weeks of for us, what can we learn from these types of predictions? Not just the prediction for 2012, but what else can we learn about sort of our system of politics and American politics from this kind of predictive activity? What's the takeaway beyond just, you know, does it work to predict the outcome of an election?
I think the value of these kinds of models is not just in terms of their predictions, which, you know, on balance have been pretty good over the years. You know, it's rare that the bulk of the models suggest that one candidate's going to win, but then the other candidate wins. I think the other value is in trying to test some of our theories about the way that elections depend to some extent on fundamentals like people's assessments of the president or the way that the economy is trending. And so the value of doing this kind of exercise in this book, I think, is it's trying to sort of get our baseline expectations correct. And you can use these models to get a sense of, you know, who is favored to win and by how much. And if you don't use these models, I think you're susceptible to sort of your own gut, your own instinct. And that's a pretty fallible way of making these kinds of decisions. And I've seen this several times in news coverage in the last several months where, you know, commentators, quite prominent people, obviously close followers of politics, were saying things like, it's absolutely, you know, stunning that Obama is winning this race. He should never have been winning this race because of the state of the economy. This is, and so therefore Mitt Romney is a bad candidate, or Mitt Romney's not running a very good campaign. And that's just absolutely incorrect. You know, the fundamentals don't predict that Obama should definitely lose this race. They predict a close race, perhaps actually favoring him. And so if your baseline expectation is correctly calibrated to the fundamentals, then I think you start making better inferences about the way in which the campaign does and does not matter. So at this point, I don't think it's entirely clear yet that Mitt Romney's campaign, you know, is definitively dooming him or leading him to run, you know, much worse than he would be expected to run, just given the way that the fundamentals break out.
Right. And how applicable is this modeling below the level of the presidential election in House or Senate races?
In general, I think there are more idiosyncratic factors in House and Senate races that make this kind of modeling a more difficult enterprise. You know, at least in midterm elections, the number of seats that, you know, a party's going to control is pretty well dependent on the same kinds of factors. You know, how well is the economy doing? How popular is the president? And then also how many seats do they control in the House before the election actually happens? And, you know, the better the president's doing, the better the economy's doing, the better the incumbent party in Congress is going to do. But the more seats they control, the less well they're going to do, because typically that means they're going to be defending a lot of seats in marginal districts. You know, that predicts elections relatively well, but I think any prediction from that kind of model is just going to have a lot of uncertainty associated with it. So, you know, you're going to get predictions like, well, the Democrats are expected to gain 8 seats, plus or minus 16 or plus or minus 12,
mm-hmm,
you know, big,
right,
big margins of error like that. And I think ultimately it makes it a little bit harder to get those kinds of questions correct. And you probably get some additional value by looking and trying to get a sense of at least some of the factors that are at work in individual districts. Certainly you can take advantage of just the data on how partisan the district is, Democrat or Republican. You can also take advantage of data on whether the incumbent's running for re-election. But I think some of the value in what the handicappers do, like Charlie Cook or Stuart Rothenberg or Larry Sabatow, is they're looking at some of the individual characteristics of the candidates, and they're maybe even better able to tell, you know, which incumbents are in trouble and which challengers have a chance of beating them. And the advantage of House races and Senate races is there's just so many more of them than we have presidential races that,
right,
you're actually able to leverage a lot more data to get this.
Right. So I noticed that sort of a forthcoming July 2013 release date. Can we expect over the next couple of months additional pre-release chapters to be posted at the Princeton University Press website?
That's our plan. I think we're definitely going to have one more come out it may not actually get out until after the election, and this is where we're just not working quite fast enough. Maybe our old academic habits are kicking in here. But we do have another chapter on the GOP primary that takes the race from the Iowa caucus until Romney's de facto nomination after Santorum drops out of the race. And that chapter is almost finished in draft form, but it still has to go through peer review and it still needs to be formatted and released. So I'm guessing that's going to come out in November. And I think at that point, we're mainly going to focus just on finishing the final manuscript for the print volume. We probably have a deadline of about January. So that gives us maybe 2 months to write 2 to 3 chapters on the general election, and then also to sort of sum up the election as a whole and try to write, you know, an appropriate introduction and conclusion to the book.
Yeah. The ambition alone, not to mention the quality of the writing of this first piece, is just very, very impressive. And so John Sides and Lynn Vavreck are the authors of The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Presidential Election, soon to be published by Princeton University Press. John, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.